From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Well, Happy New Year seems a little bit of an oxymoron this year, but rather than swimming in despair, let's celebrate a life well lived. 2 days before Christmas, writer Joan Didion passed away at the age of 87. Since her death, scores of essayists have been looking at her legacy, in particular, her affinity for dissecting California and Californians. Few writers have loved a place so dearly and ripped it apart so thoroughly as did Didion. But it's art columnist Carolina Miranda who gave us at Good Food a thread we could pull to remember this towering writer. Her remembrance turns on a simple potato masher. Hi, Carolina.
Hello, Evan. Happy New Year.
Same to you. Such an interesting essay you wrote. You ask in the essay if a single object can contain within it the narratives of a family and an entire nation. Tell us about the potato masher and the family that carried it.
Well, this is me and my weird obsessions when I read things. This is in Joan Didion's Where I Was From, a very famous book examining her California roots. And she talks about this potato masher that came with her ancestors on the westward journey in the middle of the 19th century with her family. Interestingly enough, her ancestors were part of the Donner-Reed party, of the infamous Donner Party, except her branch of the family split with the Donner Party in Nevada and then made for Oregon, so they didn't get stuck in Donner Pass as some of the other folks did. And one of the objects they carried with them on this cross-country journey, along with, you know, numerous family possessions, was this potato masher. And this potato masher had been handed down over the generations, 5 generations, to Joan Didion, and a cousin of her mom's donated it to a university in Oregon, along with a number of other objects that had also made that journey. So it was this very humble object that made this very epic journey, that is one of the great, you know, narratives of American history, and which, you know, Joan Didion spends some time in Where I Was From puncturing.
I mean, it's so interesting because most of us have myths in our family that either surround an object or a story that we hang on to, and that so much of our belief system becomes attached to it in circuitous ways.
Exactly. You know, it's this thing where certain objects, almost like, you know, having grown up Catholic, I almost think of the sacralized object, you know, the saint's relic. You know, you go to the church to look at the skull or the finger bone or the, you know, broom that they used. And there's something holy about seeing this thing that is connected with this somewhat mythical figure. And I feel like for families, you know, there is always that. There is the treasured table or jewel or book or photograph that is handed down over the generations and somehow survives. And each generation adds like a layer of narrative to it so that by the time you inherit it, it really becomes this very powerful object. And, you know, Didion is kind of lampooning it. She's looking at it with a somewhat absurdist eye at the same time that she's recognizing that this potato masher really is so important to her family, not because it's a potato masher, but because it is part of this story.
A story which she then proceeds to obliterate.
Yes, because Didion is Didion. You know, I think so much of Where I Was From is about taking that narrative thread of the myth of California, of the, you know, the hardy pioneers who crossed the United States and crossed the Sierras to make it to California, to build California what it is. She was taking that narrative and she was pulling at some of its threads to see how much of it held up. And I think, you know, one of the things that she goes into a lot in that book is about how, yes, there were a lot of rugged pioneers who made these like incredible epic journeys that were, you know, fraught with death and illness and challenge. But a lot of that was funded by the federal government, and that these very sort of quote unquote independent minded individuals, these rugged individuals, were in fact supported by this very large scale enterprise. And that is what the book is about. And she uses the potato masher as the somewhat, you know, there's so many objects she could have chosen. Her uncle donated several items to the museum, including a little lap desk. There was a cape. All of these things that made the cross-country journey. And Didion chose the potato masher as the somewhat absurdist object to talk about these myths and how, you know, these myths can imbue a potato masher with deep resonance. Like, it's not just a potato masher. It's a potato masher that made the Westward Ho. And she does it in an absurdist, but also a poignant way. I mean, she recognizes the power that these narratives have, you know, also admitting that she never went to the museum to actually visit the potato masher. I have to confess that if I'm in Oregon, I will definitely go visit the potato masher because I'm now obsessed with it.
In what museum does this object now reside?
It's in the archives of Pacific University, which is a small university in Forest Grove, Oregon, which is outside of Portland.
One of the reasons I found your essay so interesting, aside from the fact that Joan Didion chose this potato masher to become this metaphor throughout that book, is how you talk about how American culture venerates some overland journeys of immigration while others are either ignored or vilified, especially the myth of El Norte.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's something when I reread Where I Was From a number of years ago, and in looking at how Didion deconstructs this myth of that's attached to the overland journey, it was this moment in which there were a lot of Mexican and Central American migrants and refugees arriving on the border with the United States. And, you know, when you talk about epic journeys, that journey through Central America, through Mexico, across the Sonoran Desert into the United States is an epic journey. It's one rife with many of the tales of which the Westward Ho was laden. You know, the stories of death, of illness, of sacrifice, of violence. All of those stories are part of those immigrant journeys as well. If you think about the dangerous journeys Haitian immigrants make leaving Haiti, you know, in flimsy boats and facing their own mortality with, you know, this slim belief that things will be better on the other side. Yet those are journeys that we do not venerate. These are journeys that are vilified. These are journeys of outsiders, not the insiders who built this country, but of other individuals. That's how they are portrayed in our society. And I think Didion's book got me thinking so much about that, because in taking apart one narrative, she then sets the stage for us to consider, like, well, you know, what other narratives are there and how are we approaching them? How are we regarding them?
And I appreciate this reminder so much, because certainly that is one thing I believe that is happening in the food world now, is this attempt to turn stories on their heads and find the threads that tell a more nuanced story of foods and memories and myths. Thank you so much for thinking that way and writing that fabulous essay.
Oh, thank you so much. And then hopefully one day we'll go on a road trip to go visit, as I like to call it, the potato masher of Manifest Destiny.
Such a perfect title for it. Thank you so much, Carolina.
Thank you, Evan, for having me on, and Happy New Year to everyone.
Carolina Miranda is a Los Angeles Times columnist covering culture with a focus on art and architecture. Joan Didion passed away at the age of 87, just 2 days before Christmas. Check out our website for photos of the epic masher. I promise it is not what you're expecting. See for yourself at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, I don't believe in New Year's resolutions, but a pantry refresh, well, that's something I can get behind. We explore the ins and outs of sesame oil and why a good bottle is worth the splurge when we return.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Ask me about olive oil and I can talk for hours. Yet even though I have a few jars of sesame oil in the pantry, I know so little about it beyond the characteristic robust character of the roasted kind. Writer Kathy Irway wrote about the pantry staple for the online magazine Taste, and she joins us to explore one of the oldest oils used for cooking. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. I actually just had a mang chi recipe for steamed eggs that I saw on TikTok.
Yum. That's that such she a good tops, classic.
Yeah, that she tops with sesame oil, and it was so good.
Did you have it?
Yeah, it's like a magic trick almost. Yeah.
It's just simple. It's all you need. Just like, you know, olive oil just dabbed a little bit on a piece of good bread.
So I have so many questions, but since we were comparing it to olive oil, are the health benefits for sesame oil similar to those of olive oil?
Well, for one thing, it's a seed oil. So if anyone has allergies to seeds or nuts, you know, it's a totally different type of plant. That said, it is a very healthy oil. It has tons of minerals, especially when you have it cold pressed, which I think we'll get into in a little bit. It has just lots of minerals, and it's also just, you know, healthy cooking fat. I mean, there's a reason why it's been used for so many years and why it's still used and so prevalently throughout the world.
So it's so funny, you know, when I think about a seed like a sesame seed, it's so hard for me to imagine oil coming out of that tiny little thing. Can you sort of take us through what the process is for making a cold-pressed sesame oil?
Well, sesame seeds are actually very, very oily. They're something around 50% oil in its construct. I love to just take a sesame seed, you know, that's on your bagel or something like that, and if you just pinch it, it just oozes oil. So basically these sesame oil makers who are doing it in the roasted fashion, as like in many East Asian cuisines, you have like the dark sort of toasted sesame oil. What they're doing is toasting it over often an open fire, but nowadays a lot of them use convection ovens just to get them into a uniform brown toasted color and depth of flavor. Then what they do, and it's like I've seen videos of this, you know, at Donghe, which is a 100-year-old maker of it in Taiwan. They were describing this to me, but basically they take these toasted seeds and squeeze them on these like wheels and like pack them in. Like, so they're like these really dense cakes that are then taken to this mechanical press, and they're just like squeezed together really hard, so the oil just drips into these vats that catch it. It's pretty simple, but, you know, it takes a lot of machinery that nowadays that's simple machinery compared to most manufacturers.
So it's akin to extra virgin olive oil, which is a mechanical process, not a chemical one.
Absolutely.
And what will a properly made sesame oil taste like? And maybe give us a compare and contrast to a roasted sesame oil and one that isn't roasted.
Well, I mean, that adds a whole different sort of dimension of variations, that how well it's roasted, the seeds, that is, before they're pressed. So, and that's going to reflect in the color and as well as the flavor. So there's that. And then there are different, you know, seeds that just taste different. For instance, really big, easy to spot difference is black sesame seeds versus white sesame seeds. They have different flavor profiles. black sesame seeds in Asian medicine is associated more with like heating energy. And so it's thought to be good for winter. And then there's like, you know, terroir. I mean, I was hearing all about like the difference in taste. They have like some single origin sesame oils at Donghe. So there's slightly, you know, differences wherever they're grown. There's not, you know, a whole lot of growers of them and of sesame seeds themselves right now in Taiwan. So a lot of them are from Thailand, which has slightly different flavor than the ones that are from Taiwan, as they found. So terroir is also important.
That's so interesting. For those of us that don't have a ton of experience cooking with sesame oil or buying it for that matter, is there a way by telling the quality just by smelling? I mean, like with olive oil, if you get rancid oil, it's so easy to smell that.
Same for sesame seed oil. I think that you can definitely smell a stale flavor. The fresher, the better. It can also get bland over time, similar to olive oil. You know, you're dealing with a live product, so freshness is definitely to be prized. And, you know, we all have like those bottles of something that sit around in our cabinets for a long time. But if it's a pure sesame oil, and nowadays there are some, you know, companies that may add flavorings and who knows what else in there. But if it's a pure sesame oil, it, you know, will naturally sort of lose some of its oomph over the time.
Are there different types of oil that you would use in cooking? Mm-hmm. Like if it's going to be heated versus drizzling or finishing?
Yes, definitely. You know, your top shelf expensive sesame oil, you might want to just save that for drizzling, like on your steamed eggs, for instance. So you don't heat it all, so you don't lose all that wonderful flavor. I love doing this with like congee or even a soup. If you have a nice soup, like say you got hot and sour soup or something, or wontons. Definitely wontons or dumplings. Just drizzle a little bit of your good sesame oil on top, or any sesame oil for that matter. And, you know, don't heat it further than that. And it's wonderful. Sesame oil is great to cook with as well. It will lose some of that flavor as you bring it to a high temperature, but it'll still imbue it with tons of flavor. And so a classic example of cooking with sesame oil is going to be the Taiwanese 3-cup chicken, which is a wonderful dish, but the 3 cups in its name refer to sesame oil, rice wine, and soy sauce. It's basically braised in those 3 liquids.
It's so delicious, too.
It's so good, yeah.
So where can we find, I guess, is there a hint as to whether or not an oil is of better quality when we're at the Asian supermarket in terms of price?
Yeah, I mean, Asian supermarkets, their offerings may vary widely. And, you know, if it's a small store, they may only have one type, and that's, I'm sure it'll suffice. But if you really want to kind of geek out and explore and taste and smell some more, there's a lot you can find online. There's also sesame seeds themselves. I don't know how to make the oil from there, but like those can be really fun to get, like a really nice high quality sesame seed. There is a variety called Beni seeds, which is actually from Africa original. Actually, all sesame seeds are from Africa. But you can purchase it online. It is used in Gullah Geechee communities and cooking. So you can actually buy it online as well. I mean, online nowadays, you can get lots of stuff and you can explore. But it does help to kind of have somebody to guide you a little bit. So maybe at an Asian store, they can clue you in a little bit.
Yeah, I was poking around at the links in your taste mm-hmm. article, and one of the brands that Huni Kim in your article recommended is sold out, which is hilarious.
Oh, wow.
And wonderful.
Oh, okay.
But then I went on to the other link, which is the 100-year-old mill in Taiwan that you reference, mm-hmm. and they still have some. So I'm definitely going to buy one because I'm so curious.
It is so good. And I'm really into, because now it's winter, taking that black sesame oil, because they have both white and black sesame oil, and just like drizzling it on something, some warm soup, just even like an egg with a little bit of soy sauce, like a fried egg. It's just heaven.
So delicious. Well, thank you so much, Kathy. I mean, I always love learning about more condiments that I can stuff into my pantry.
You're welcome.
Kathy Irway is the author of the cookbook, The Food of Taiwan, and the memoir, The Art of Eating In. She hosts the podcasts Self-Evident and Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. We've got a link to the piece she wrote on sesame oil, along with her bottle recommendations, on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. The next generation of Americans may look at a gas stove the way Gen Z looks at a rotary phone. As more research is being conducted on the effects of gas usage in homes, and with bans slowly taking hold across the country, Los Angeles Times staff writer Evan Halper reported on how the flames of gas stoves are slowly flickering out. You know, for a chef, this is hard to take, even though I understand. Why are municipalities rethinking the use of gas stoves?
Well, the main reason is climate change. You know, the gas lines that go into homes and businesses, they create about 10% of the climate pollution nationwide. And the one appliance that people have a really hard time parting with is the gas stove. It's not, you know, a major share of that climate pollution, but it's kind of the one wedge into people's homes and businesses when, you know, activists come around and talk about we need to shut the gas lines. The best argument against it is, well, then you'll lose your gas stove. And that concerns people a lot more than, you know, possibly having to convert their gas dryer and go electric or, you know, move into an electric heating system. It's that stove that people have an emotional attachment to.
Yeah, I certainly understand that. It's interesting. For a time recently, I was cooking on an induction burner and I became way more sensitized to how much more efficient it was. And now whenever I put a pot on the gas burner and see the flame curling up around it, I'm so aware of how much of that energy source just gets volatilized into the air.
Yeah, it is interesting since I started reporting on this, how aware I've become of my gas stove at home, which was something I was very, you know, I moved into a new house about a year ago and I was very excited about this big gas range in this house I moved into, you know, and now I keep looking at it, you know, in a very different way. What you said about sort of the heat you're losing, the climate impacts. And, you know, of course, part of our story was also about the potential health impacts of using a gas stove versus induction.
What are those?
Well, they're still being studied, but the Rocky Mountain Institute did a look at the literature and found that children in homes with gas stoves were significantly more likely to have asthma than children in homes, you know, with electric stoves. And one reason for this, they theorize, is that when you burn a gas stove, obviously some gases are escaping into the air. You know, there's NOx, there's formaldehyde, you know, there's methane. And what you have now is a bunch of scientists going around the country trying to look closer at how much emissions release is happening when people are burning gas stoves and what are the health impacts. You know, one way to avert those health impacts is to use your, to use a hood and to turn that fan on. But many of us, myself included, and, you know, the scientists from Stanford I talked to when I was doing this story are among the, you know, the masses who just never turn that thing on. It's kind of loud. It's an inconvenience, but it really does make a difference if you're still using a gas stove to turn that hood on if you're worried about, you know, particulate matter and breathing those gases in.
That's really interesting and good advice. What part of California is leading the way in banning gas appliances in new homes and businesses?
It's very much a Bay Area thing right now. And this all started in Berkeley. You know, and one reason it started in Berkeley, I mean, obviously it's one of the most progressive cities in the country, and there's a real interest in taking climate action, and city leaders in Berkeley were growing impatient with the pace of climate action in the state and the country, so they wanted to sort of take the lead. But also, it depends on your utility. Pacific Gas and Electric is the utility in the Bay Area, as you know. And, you know, they do gas and they do electric, and they do not see this as a big threat, you know, an existential threat to their business if bans on gas lines start, because they just get more electric customers. In Southern California, it's more complicated. You know, Southern California gas doesn't do electricity. They do gas. And for them, this is like really an existential threat. If cities start passing bans, you know, bans of gas hookups in new homes or existing homes, that company sees a lot of its business just go away. So it's fighting this very hard.
Do you think that there will be a statewide law as opposed to just individual municipalities coming online?
I think that's probably coming somewhere down the line. You know, the California Energy Commission looked at this recently and decided not to move forward with a state ban right now. However, the International Energy Agency is warning that, you know, gas hookups into houses and businesses need to stop, and they're urging municipalities, states, national governments to wean their populations off of natural gas, at least natural gas hookups into homes and businesses. So somewhere down the line, if we're going to meet our climate goals, states are going to have to start passing these bans.
And what states are embracing this kind of change versus other states where the policy is being viewed as questionable and receiving opposition?
Yeah, this will not surprise you. This falls very much along, you know, political lines. So deep blue states on the coast are moving forward with these bans, or municipalities in those states, I should say, are kind of aggressively moving forward. New York City just passed its ban a few weeks ago, and that was a really big deal because buildings in New York City account for something like 5% of the natural gas climate pollution coming from you know, homes and businesses. But on the other hand, the gas companies have pushed back very hard, and they persuaded 20 states to pass bans on bans. So in states like Texas, what you're seeing is they're passing these prohibitions on municipalities doing anything like Berkeley did. So if Austin wants to go ahead and pass a ban, they can't do that in Texas now.
You know, I'm old enough to remember the magical period in the 60s and 70s of the all-electric home, which was this kind of futuristic promise that fell flat, largely because electric stoves were so bad. How have the instruments, the cooking instruments that we will be asked to rely upon, how have they developed and changed over time?
Yeah, that's a really important point you make, because one of the reasons these induction stoves are proving a hard sell is that electric stoves were just so bad for so long. The induction technology available now is a very different kind of thing. We went to a, you know, very nice kitchen showroom in the Valley, and, you know, we got a demonstration from a Newport Beach chef. And it was really amazing to me, the kinds of things that she was able to do on this stove and the precision that it had, and, you know, the different kinds of cooking that you could do that I just assumed, you know, no way. Celebrity chef Martin Yan has done demonstrations where he cooks on an induction wok, which it just seems like wok cooking is made for a gas stove, but, you know, he's an evangelist for these induction stoves. The technology is developing. In some ways, it's a lot like the electric car. You know, the early adapters have access, you know, if you have the resources to buy a really fancy induction stove, it can do really cool things. You know, the prices are coming down for the rest of us, but it's still a rapidly developing technology, but it's nothing like the electric stoves of, you know, even a decade ago.
How is the restaurant industry responding?
The restaurant industry, for the most part, is not liking this. And what you're seeing is they're insisting on carve-outs in various cities for restaurants, because obviously it's a huge expense for a restaurant to make the conversion, although in most cases you're talking about new restaurants. But even so, you know, I talked to one restaurant owner in Los Angeles who just said, look, if you're in a restaurant, just the reality is, like, the pots and pans are getting banged up all the time. This guy ran a steakhouse in Marina Del Rey. And you need to have, you know, pans that have a flat surface to work on an induction stove. So he said, just there, you know, you've got a major challenge. I mean, this is not a easy transition. And, you know, there's certain types of cooking that happens at restaurants that, you know, you can't do electrically. I mean, how do you do a Korean barbecue on an induction stove? Obviously, that's not going to work. But, you know, you do need to look at this like you look at the transition toward electric cars. It's something, you know, when those cars first started rolling off the assembly lines in the early 1990s, they called them compliance cars. They just seemed like such a ridiculous thing. Who's going to drive these? This is a government mandate. But then over time, you know, they became competitive with, you know, gasoline cars, and ultimately to a large segment of the population, preferable. And, you know, that's where a lot of folks who are pushing electrification feel like this induction cooking is going.
Well, thank you so much, Evan. This has been really, really interesting. And I really encourage people to just give induction burners a try.
Yeah, I think it's worth checking out. And I appreciate you having me on, Evan. Thank you.
Evan Halper is a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, where he reports on policy issues out of Washington, D.C. In a minute, the art of fufu. We learn how to make it, how to eat it, and what to pair the West African staple with when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Food is symbolic, and stretching all across West Africa, fufu is personalized and woven into the lives and stories of families. When you eat fufu and soup, you're stepping into history, experiencing a rich cultural heritage, writes Chef Kavachi Ugebu. Hi, Kavachi.
How are you? Thanks for having me on your show.
I'm so grateful that you could join us.
Thanks for having me.
Fufu is a staple food of West African culture. For people who have never had it or never seen it, can you describe it and tell us what its main components are?
Okay, so fufu is usually the vehicle into the soup. And fufu is usually pounded yam, which is yam tuber. You have cassava, you have cocoa yam, and I want to say oatmeal, which is considered wheat fufu. And fufu usually is eaten with a hearty vegetable soup. It can be vegetable from melon seed, mango seed, akazi, spinach, peanut soup. So most of the times, all of our West African soups are tribal-based, and it can stem from Nigeria, Ghana, Cameroon, Senegal, Liberia. And Liberia is known for their cassava soup. So there's a most of the time when I explain to people about fufu, I always say it's just the vehicle into the main soup. And the soup is majority of the times vegan.
So when you say vehicle, do you mean that it is used with your fingers instead of an implement like a spoon or a fork?
Exactly. And most of the time, you can kind of tell who is not familiar with fufu if they bring out the cutlery to eat it. So as a child, you are pretty much eating with your hands, which is fun.
And there's a traditional setup that restaurants, or if you're in the house, people will bring you to prepare you for digging in to the soup with your fufu. Can you describe what comes to the table?
The proper food etiquette when eating fufu is to wash your hands in a basin bowl. It usually comes with water. Some people have like a soap water. And we always say your water is your cutlery. Like, you're using your hands. You can trust your hands when eating the food. So you always have to wash your hands because you touch so many things. So being that you're going to be using your hands to eat fufu, it's customary to offer any of your guests a basin full of water with soap and a napkin.
So one of the things that I think is so interesting is many of us who have never experienced West African food, we're used to eating starches with our soups or our stews, things like bread or rice or potatoes. And certainly with rice, because it's all these little grains, it's harder to eat with your hands, although there are plenty of people in India who do it. But fufu has a particular texture often that makes it easier to sort of turn into your own little scoop. Are there like personalized moves that you make? Like, are there different ways? Like, you know, some people when they're eating with tortillas will tear them. Some people will roll them up. Is there the same kind of personalization with fufu?
Yes, to answer your question. Inside of our book, we have a page where it teaches everyone how to roll fufu the correct way. And if you're starting off, I would always say to roll it with two hands. But as you begin to get comfortable with rolling fufu, people tend to just roll it with one hand. And everybody's mouth is different. And depending on the soup, if it's just straight okra, you're going to have to chew okra. You can't swallow okra. Some of the soups that are like agusi, it's blended melon seed. Some people are able to just swallow that whole. So depending on the soup, that kind of gives you the idea of how big the fufu ball should be.
Do people make an indentation in the ball?
Yes, they pinch it in the center.
And sometimes it's referred to as a swallow. Yeah. Why is that?
Okay, now going back to what I said, depending on your level and your comfort, people tend to, I grew up eating fufu. And so when I was small, I remember my mom telling me, like, I remember her hitting me saying, listen, you don't chew, you swallow. So I feel like as I got older, I'm so used to swallowing it because depending on the soup, if it's like vegetable soup, I can swallow that. But if it's okra soup, I have to chew because the okras are usually, I can't swallow the okra. Whenever I'm teaching my cooking class or explaining to them about eating fufu, I always say, let's just start up small. As a small bowl, like a small ball, and then kind of work ourselves up.
Do you watch people kind of an obsession be created right then in the moment when they're experiencing it for the first time?
It's interesting because most of the time when I explain, I can always kind of ask them, like, what vegetable are you familiar with? And most of people will gravitate to okra. But then I always say there's like starter soups. And our starter soups are usually the more user-friendly, which is the agusi, vegetable, and okra. As you begin to experience these different types of flavors, your taste palate tends to be more mature to actually have the native soup. And the native soups are really just full of flavor. So once I kind of introduce them to more softer soups and they get used to it, I move them over to the native soups and they're like, oh, this is actually really good. So they kind of like within time, they mature. Because I remember I couldn't even eat bitter leaf soup. And bitter leaf soup is the very most medicinal vegetable soup that you can think of. And as I got older, I'm like, this is my comfort soup. I love bitter leaf. When I was a child, it was okra soup. But then as I got older, I love bitter leaf soup. Whenever you're having any like indigestion problems, bitter leaf soup is going to help you. It's very medicinal.
What is the bitter leaf in the soup?
It's a vegetable that's grown in West Africa, and a lot of the ladies that are during pregnancy time, when they feel a little bit nauseous, my mom will make bitter leaf soup for them, and that's most of the Igbos, they eat bitter leaf soup.
Is it available here dried, or are you able to get it fresh?
It's dried. When I went to Nigeria and saw the actual fresh vegetable, I was like, I prefer it dried.
Oh, that's interesting. When you do your cooking classes, do people kind of fall in love with fufu too? Do they're like, oh, damn, now I have another starch that I have to add to my repertoire of eating?
I remember when I introduced all my friends. You can't be my friend and not have a soup. I'm sorry. Like, if you come to Houston, you're going to eat a soup because I want you to be able to try different flavors. And especially whenever I'm introducing my vegan friends to fufu, they're like, wow, they're so in awe. They're like, these melon seeds can actually make a soup. They're so blown away that this particular seeds can turn into a well-beloved soup. So I always love how people are so exposed and they're like, wow. And with the Art of Fufu book, a lot of people who were not raised on this soup are actually taking the initiative and really understanding more about West African food, and especially the African diaspora. Our parents were so busy making a living for us that they didn't really give us time to actually learn how to make the soups. So with the Art of Fufu, we're really helping a lot of Africans and non-Africans understand our staple food. And inside the book, we're actually giving you a guide of each ingredient and explaining to you the essence of the soup and what the soup consists of.
Well, the book is lovely, and the photographs will inspire people who love to cook at home to try something new, I'm sure.
Thank you.
That was Chef Kavachi Ugebu. Her family opened Safari, the first Nigerian restaurant in Houston, in 1996, and her book, which was published last year, is The Art of Fufu. The return of the new year means the return of restaurant reviews for LA Times restaurant critic Bill Addison. Bill is back in the saddle, and we're ready to pull up a chair. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Evan.
You called Horses the city's most exhilarating dining experience of the year for you. That's pretty high praise. What makes it so?
First, it begins with the entrance. It's a very empty block on Sunset, in the western-ish end of Hollywood, very still, very quiet. And then you pull open the door of this facade painted Eve Klein electric blue, and it's a little bit of a riot inside, which is wild to talk about at this moment in the pandemic. But it is an only in LA blur of scenery in this restaurant. It is the famous, the near famous, the famous lookalikes, and the rest of us all in this place that looks like a pub in another dimension, and one that likely is not in the lingering throes of a global pandemic. It's a pretty incredible place to be right now.
And it's a place with just a huge pedigree. I mean, years and years and years of deep Hollywood cuts.
Yes. So it's kind of a strange name for a restaurant, Horses, until you understand the context, which is for over 70 years, it was Ye Coach and Horses Pub, opened in the 1930s when Hollywood was on its global ascent, as talkies were taking over the world. And actors of yesteryear, like Richard Burton, made it their home. And then gradually, as the rare LA institution does, it just becomes a local neighborhood hangout for decades. Ye Coach and Horses closed early last decade. It was brought back to life for about a decade as the Pikey. The Pikey opened kind of in that moment when seemingly every restaurant with an ambitious food and drink program was being called a gastropub. And the Pikey really wasn't a gastropub, and Horses really isn't a gastropub. It is just a restaurant in a space with a really cool lineage.
So let's talk first about the food. What were some of the highlights of the menu for you, and also, I'm sure, cocktails as well?
Absolutely. So it's a little hard to define this menu, which I think is fun in a way, but if you have to label it, you might call it Continental Californian, a very friendly mix of Spanish, Italian, and French kind of ideas with the expected Southern California homegrown seasonality. The dish that I land on first whenever I'm thinking about this restaurant is the Boudin Basque. It is a variation of morcilla, or blood sausage. And blood sausage can sometimes be a very smooth emulsion. This one has a lot of texture The chefs incorporate chopped meat from pig's head and also a lot of caramelized onions. And so it has this sort of like almost like pleasantly like mysterious, almost mulchy texture to it. And they put it over a slice of toasted brioche with a very oozy fried egg over top of it. It's amazing. And what's maybe even more amazing is that Angelinos are really digging it. It's a dish for the new decade and one that people are embracing.
And I understand that they have a delicious take on a Caesar.
One of the things that I think is really cool about this restaurant is that the chefs, Liz Johnson and Will Agajanian, thought a lot when they were conceiving the menu about how to kind of insinuate the restaurant organically into LA food culture. A Caesar was a natural path to that means. And for this one, they take endive rather than romaine, and they eschew croutons. They use scattered breadcrumbs instead. They include Parmesan only in the dressing, but instead they shower it with grated mimolet, that nutty kind of orangey cheese. And it all comes together really beautifully. It's bright, it's crunchy, a little creamy. It's kind of everything that you want a salad like this to be. Even if Cesare Cardini, who invented the salad in 1920s era Tijuana, would not recognize it at all.
So aside from the food, there's something to be talked about at Horses in terms of how the kitchen is put together. Your colleague Stephanie Brejo wrote an article on it.
Yes, she did. The two chefs in charge, Johnson and Agajanian, make the team of chefs incredibly inclusive. So it also includes co-executive chefs Brittany Ha and Lee Pallarino and pastry chef Hannah Groba. And it's an effort to derail this lingering notion in restaurant hierarchies about chefs on a pedestal and make it a more egalitarian approach to who leads and who makes the major decisions in a kitchen.
I have to ask you what it's like reviewing restaurants at this moment in time.
It's a great question. I ate at Horses before the Omicron variant spun out of control, if I can use those words, in the way it has right now when we're talking in mid-January 2022. I don't know what to say. I don't, right now, at this moment, want to be eating indoors in restaurants. And I will say that Horses has no outdoor seating nor takeout. It is an indoor dining restaurant. If you shut down restaurants again, you face the same financial calamities that befell the industry 2 years ago, and from which most of them have never quite recovered. As a critic, I am for right now, right this moment, going back to focusing on takeout and restaurants that have outdoor dining. I'm also not advocating for people to stop eating in restaurants because restaurants need diners to survive. There's no good answer.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And I really look forward to eating in Horses when I feel like I'm willing to go inside.
I agree. It's a fraught, imperfect calculus. And it's the place to have on top of your list when you're feeling ready.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Evan.
Bill Addison is the restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Times. We've been talking about Horses, which he describes as LA's most exhilarating dining experience of the last year. We've got a link to his review and a list of his favorite dishes on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Up next, Coneheads. Conehead cabbage is back at the market, and we've got ideas for what to do with it next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Let's head now to the farmer's market, where Jillian Ferguson is masked up to bring us her weekly report.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report, and I am so happy to be back at the market where winter produce is in full swing. Conehead cabbage, a personal favorite, has been rearing its pointy head for a few weeks now, and here to tell us what to do with it are the co-owners behind Della Nona in the Arts District. It's Patrick Costa and Jose Cordon. Hello to you both.
Hello, how are you?
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. So Della Nona from the grandma, what is the grandma approved way of cooking conehead cabbage?
The Della Nona way is just low and slow. We're not trying to overwhelm the actual product. I think just really exemplifying what it is and how they grow it. The farmers do such an incredible job growing it. Nature does everything else. We just put some salt and olive oil on it.
Exactly.
It kind of takes everything else.
Yeah. So before we get to the how you're cooking it, why conehead cabbage in particular, as opposed to, let's say, Savoy or Napa?
I think it's so interesting. Conehead cabbage kind of popped up a few years ago. It's a little bit sweeter. It's not as tough. Very tender leaves, so you don't have to overcook it. You don't have to braise it as long as you do other things. So you can enjoy it in a much fresher way where it's not covered with meat or sauce or anything like that. So conehead cabbage is just this beautiful new way to experience something that's been around that maybe has a back stigma.
Oh gosh, I mean, it's just so much fun to say. It's so much fun to look at.
Right.
It really does look like conehead. It's a talking point. So you mentioned braising. Is that how you're cooking it?
So we're cooking it a la cartocho, so in its own envelope. And that kind of keeps all the flavors and aroma and lightly steams the bag with the aromatics. We cook them individually so we can really make sure that each one is prepared to the best quality.
And what aromatics are you using?
So winter, we're here. So I've got rosemary, which is some absolute favorite, and some fresh oregano. After that's cooked, I sear it hard in a cast iron pan, get the nice caramelization. Then we top it with a brown butter caper vinaigrette and some bocarones, which is absolutely delicious. Little salty sea bites.
Yum. And remind everybody what bocarones are.
Bocarones are marinated Spanish white anchovy that just a little bit of acidity, super tangy, and it kind of cuts through that rich brown butter. And the sweetness of that with the cone cabbage is it's outstanding.
It sounds like something that people could do at home, too. If people don't have parchment paper at home, could they just wrap it in foil?
Yeah, absolutely. You could use aluminum foil. You could even use a little Dutch oven, just olive oil on the bottom with a lid and do it on lower heat for about 15 minutes. And you have this like beautiful tender. You still have some texture with the cone cabbage. And salt and olive oil goes such a long way. It brings out that natural flavor. So you can actually absolutely do it at home, and I recommend it.
Now, the bulk of your menu at Della Nona is actually pizza, along with all these great market sides. So every week you have a rotating market-inspired pizza. What's on top of that this week?
So this week we're doing charred escarole with a little bit of onion, chili flake, preserved Meyer lemon ricotta, and shaved Bottarga on top. Mm. It is absolutely delicious. The escarole gets like charred and crispy in the oven. And we're just loving it. Absolutely love it. Just another beautiful winter bitter green.
Sounds fantastic. Thank you both so much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
That was Patrick Costa and Jose Cordon, co-owners and visionaries behind Della Nona, a coastal Italian restaurant on 4th Street in the Arts District. Here to further demystify the winter powerhouse that is cabbage is Alex Weiser from Weiser Family Farms. He grows a few varieties up in Tehachapi and Lamont. Hi, Alex.
Good morning.
So let's start with the conehead cabbage, which I was just talking to the chefs at Della Nona about. When did you start growing this? I feel like it just showed up at the market a few years ago.
I would say a few years ago.
Yeah.
Yes. I love the look of them and reading about them and talking to Europeans who raved about them. And, you know, at farmers markets, we always want to do different and things that are not at every supermarket. So their looks, but also their use. They were well-known in Europe for being used for sauerkraut. And then through the feedback from chefs, they grill fantastic. And they're sweeter. We started 2 years ago, but it's the feedback we get. It's the people running back and raving about it, that there is a difference between conehead cabbages and round cabbages.
Yeah. And where in Europe are they from? Do you know?
I think Germany. Holland, Germany. You'll see them in Amsterdam and people think, oh, this is a new cabbage. Oh, where did this come from? But they've actually been around for centuries. They've been around a long time. Mm-hmm. But being conehead, they're not conducive to commercial packing and wrapping and and fitting in a box and things like that. But it's all about the flavor for us and uniqueness. And
what do they look like when they grow? Because they are so unique, that pointy top.
You know what? Often they're eaten before they even become a cabbage. You can, and I've been reading it in Europe that they actually use them as a green because they kind of have a wrap. Mm-hmm. So they wrap around. They're great for wraps too. So you can use them at an earlier stage and use them as greens, as fresh greens. But as time goes by, they develop the head that lasts longer.
Sure. And you have both the purple and the green varieties. What's the difference between the two?
I think the green one's a little sweeter.
Okay. And speaking of sweetness, oftentimes it's cold weather that really brings out that sweetness in these crops. Is that true with cabbage?
That is true. And that's why right now they're particularly at their peak, because we're getting frost every night.
Really?
Yes. So right now is the best time.
Yeah. At that crazy rainstorm that we had a few weeks ago, did you get snow up in Tehachapi?
We did get snow in Tehachapi. Yes, yeah. We did. And that hill is still covered in white. The valley, it's melted, but yes, it's great for the parsnips right now. That's what certain crops we wait for frost, mm-hmm. like parsnips, sunchokes, our carrots. Right now they're juicy and crisp, and this is my favorite time of year for those root vegetables.
Oh, great. Well, thank you so much, Alex.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Alex Weiser of Weiser Family Farms. You can find Weiser and those conehead cabbage at pretty much any market in Los Angeles. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Desmond Taylor, and Nick Lamponi. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Gary Masiha, and Kenny Ng. I'm Evan Kleiman. As we honor Martin Luther King Jr. this weekend, I want to recommend an episode of KCRW's podcast, Lost Notes, which details how Stevie Wonder's song, Happy Birthday, was instrumental in cementing the MLK holiday we're observing this Monday. It's a great listen. Check it out. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food. Just how much we love you, and I'm sure you would agree, what could fit more perfectly than to have a world